honestly, straight up, knowing what I know now, number one, give him the keys to the car and have somebody somewhere just drop all the resources we need. You know, like we had in the WWE and the WWF, whether it be cameras or money or vehicles or advertising, just drop it. Have heaven open the doors and just drop it on us. In a perfect world, if we give him the keys to the car and, you know, all the resources we need, that's what needs to happen. Is that a fair answer?
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
After all these years, Hulk Hogan comes clean. What TNA has to do to be successful. By the way, in that clip that you just heard, he was referring to Eric Bischoff, not himself, as far as giving Eric Bischoff the keys to the company and getting unlimited resources. That's it. Who knew? That's all it takes for TNA to be successful. Unlimited resources. Money, advertising, cameras. Hey, for me to be successful, I would love all the unlimited resources in the world, too. I want everything at my disposal, and I can be the most successful person in the world. That was a laugh track in the end that I inserted. I don't want anybody writing into me, oh, well, you know, you're lying. They were cheering Hogan after he said that. Well, you know, of course they were cheering Hogan because that's what the people were there for. It was a Hulk Hogan Q&A. You had a bunch of Hulkamaniacs in the crowd. But I put the laugh track in there just because I felt it was so appropriate. We'll get back to those guys later. I got a lot to say about TNA this week. This is episode 290 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for first day of September 2013. I am the Sala Monster. You're listening to the show exclusively on thesalamonster.com, Stitcher, Radio On Demand, or perhaps in iTunes. You can subscribe to us there. I also want to give two shout-outs really quickly here at the beginning of the show. One to Leon S. from Philly, and another to Rodrigo from Brazil. They were both kind enough to make PayPal donations this week to the show on thesalamonster.com. So if you want to make a PayPal donation and get a shout-out, you can go there. And you'll find the box on the right-hand side of the page. Give whatever you can. Every little bit helps to support the Sound Off. And also, I have my latest Yahoo column is up. This past week it went up. It was about Sheamus. I talked about this on the Sound Off, so if you listen to the show, you get all that stuff first before everybody else does. Basically, just a column about how Sheamus's recent surgery could work to his benefit and pitching an idea for him when he gets back early next year. So you can find that on Yahoo. I link to it online if you want to look for a link there. I actually just got done watching the latest episode of the JBL and Cole show on the WWE YouTube channel. I don't get a chance to watch the show every week, but they have this gimmick going on the show with Wade Barrett. I'm not sure how many of you are aware of this, but on some of the recent episodes, they'll do this deal where, out of the blue, Wade Barrett will either, you know, bump into somebody, or this week he calls Josh Matthews, and Josh Matthews answers his phone, and basically all that Barrett does, his whole gimmick, is that he delivers bad news, and they refer to him as Bad News Barrett. So in this case, he called up Josh, basically just to bury him and give him some bad news, and mind you, the entire time he's doing this, he's in a hotel room somewhere, stroking his cat. It's Wade Barrett holding a cat, delivering bad news to other people. I think this is a tremendous gimmick. I think that that's exactly what Wade Barrett needs to get himself on TV. Bad News Barrett. That should be his new gimmick. Hopefully they can transition that over from YouTube to the main roster here, because it's not like they're doing much else with Wade Barrett these days. I don't want to say that him in a comedy gimmick is the best thing for him, but it's better than what they're doing with him now. Monday Night Raw this past week, emanating from Phoenix, Arizona. Let's go through the good, the bad, and the ugly. Some random Raw observations. Antonio Cesaro and Dolph Ziggler were relegated to the Superstars tapings this week. And in that match, Antonio Cesaro even got to beat Dolph Ziggler in the middle of the ring with his uppercut neutralizer combo, which was shocking to me when I read that result. I saw the match. We don't have superstars here where I am on TV. I think it's on the Superstation, WGN, or something like that. So I had to find a version of it online. But I watched the match. It was really good. Most impressive part to me was Cesaro standing on the second rope on the inside. He's done this before. And he lifts Ziggler up. Now, Ziggler is outside on the apron. And he lifts Dolph up straight up into the air with a delayed vertical suplex. He even got a round of applause from the crowd after he did it. Just very impressive stuff. Both men did appear in the final segment on Raw Monday night, but all they did was just stand on stage. They literally said nothing. They did nothing. You know, Renee Young was trying to interview Dolph, and he just was silent. Same with Miz. Same with Big Show. And as many of you, many of you, I can't even tell you how many people have emailed me, tweeted me, or posted on Facebook this week to point out the storyline inconsistency with the Big Show and his so-called ironclad contract. Remember when Big Show came back last year and he turned on John Cena and he was with Johnny Ace and he had the ironclad contract? He can't be fired. Nobody can touch him. He can do whatever he wants. And people were writing in wanting to know, you know, what the hell happened to the ironclad contract? Why was he so worried on the show? And on SmackDown, which I did see, and I felt was the best show of the week. We'll talk about SmackDown today as well. On that show, they had Cole and JBL on commentary attempt to explain the whole ironclad contract thing by saying the contract isn't worth the paper that it's printed on because the McMahons can just rip it up, you know, no matter what. It doesn't matter how guaranteed John Laurinaitis wanted to make the contract. That is a poor excuse. An attempt on their part to explain it, but a poor excuse. I'm going to be tearing TNA a new one for that whole Bound for Glory series debacle later on the show this week. So it's only fair that I point out this ironclad contract stuff makes absolutely no sense. So I'm with you. I have no answer for you. There is no logical explanation for why Big Show is so worried and practically in tears this man was on Friday night. Nor does it make any sense that Triple H would buy Randy Orton a brand new Escalade with his own money as a gift after last week telling us that he actually has no love lost with Randy Orton and the only reason he did what he did at SummerSlam was for business. Yes, someone bought Randy Orton a car as a gift. Sound familiar? What must Kofi Kingston be thinking watching this? You know, when he did that angle with Randy Orton back in 2009... They had a chance to make Kofi, you know, maybe not a main eventer, I don't want to say that, but somebody worth a damn on that roster. And look at the guy now. He wasn't even on the show this week. He's done nothing since he came back from elbow surgery. But if we set those little gaps in logic aside for a moment, I actually am really digging the storyline so far with the whole new corporation making, you know, Brian's life, and really Big Show, Ziggler, Miz, all of them, making their lives a living hell. It's funny to me when people complain, many of these are probably the same people who, if you would have asked them, let's say, 6 weeks ago, you know, hey, wouldn't you love it if they brought back the corporation like they had back during the Attitude Era? These people would all go gaga for the idea. Well, you've got the corporation. You've got Triple H in the Vince McMahon role. You've got Randy Orton in the Rock role as the corporate champion. And I will say, Orton is nowhere near as entertaining as The Rock was in that role. But I prefer Orton and Triple H as heels. So I'm actually enjoying it so far. I mean, I'm also enjoying having The Shield as part of their group, even though it does go against their whole, you know, justice thing. But they're back in the main event picture. You know, for a while there, they didn't seem to know what to do with these guys. They put titles on all of them, and those titles are like rat poison. Thankfully, they're back in a meaningful role again. Triple H on the show put Daniel Bryan in a gauntlet match where he would have to get through Seth Rollins first, then Dean Ambrose, then Roman Reigns, so that set up the main event. Going through the rest of my notes here, WWE loves to do polls. I think we all know that by now. They have the Raw Active polls. They had one on this show with Punk and Heyman. Later on, we'll get to that, but they also do these polls in the WWE app that you probably never hear about on TV. You'd only know about it if you actually went into the app. So those of you who don't have the app don't have to worry about this. I have the app because I love to just check out what they've got going on there. And it's not a bad app if you want to refer to it, let's say, for some information. But when it comes to this interactive nonsense, it's just a complete joke. Case in point, these are the kind of riveting polls you are missing out on if you do not have this app on your smartphone. The first poll they ran Monday night, what would you give Randy Orton as a gift for his recent actions? And the options were a black eye, a bag of coal, or a basket of venomous snakes. Yes. Another poll they ran later on. What's the hardest part of being a matador? Is it dodging the bull's horns, wearing those tight outfits, or catching all the roses from adoring fans? I am convinced they have a 9-year-old on their staff writing this stuff. So I'm hesitant to bash it too much because I'd feel really bad if I found out that it was a little kid who was writing this stuff. It's the only explanation I could come up with. No adult with an IQ above 40 would come up with questions like this. Cody Rhodes and Fandango had a match. In the middle of this match, The Miz came out with Rosa Mendez, who we haven't seen in months. The Matadors are coming back. I guess she's not going to be with them. So they come out dancing. Miz is dressed like Fandango. And, of course, Fandango himself is distracted by this. Cody Rhodes rolls him up for the pin. The distraction is easily the second worst finish in wrestling, second only to the dreaded walkout. And no sooner did I tweet that during the show on Monday night than Fandango did just that. He walked out on Damian Sandow. What happened is Brad Maddox came out. He said, listen, we're going to make a tag team match. He's doing his best Teddy Long impersonation. And he made a match. It was Cody and Miz against Fandango and Sandow. So Fandango walked out on Damian. Damian got pinned. And there you go. So we got the walkout. Part one of what I call the hat trick. For those of you who don't follow me on Twitter, I talk about this quite a bit on Monday nights. The hat trick, it's very simple, really. Every week on Raw, we get three things, in no particular order. We get a walkout finish, we get the World Heavyweight Champion being beaten and losing a match, and at least once, usually more than once, during the course of the show, we have Michael Cole on commentary before they go to a commercial break telling us, Raw rolls on. Again, like it's a train, like a runaway train. Raw will roll on. You're guaranteed to hear that at least once every week on Raw. So this was the first leg of the hat trick, and like I said, all we need now is a world champion losing and a Raw rolls on from Michael Cole. And I'm happy to report that that's exactly what we got. We got the Raw rolls on, and in his match against Rob Van Dam, Alberto Del Rio got pinned. So achievement unlocked. Hat trick. I'm seriously thinking about turning this into some sort of drinking game. I think that might be some fun for us to have on Monday nights. I mean, think about how ludicrous it is that I called that again. I needed all three things to go according to plan. I needed the stars to align. And they did. I'm begging them to change things up a little bit. Show Fandango walking into the building so we can get the walk in instead of the walk out. I mean, something. Anything. Back on the subject of polls, we had a CM Punk versus Curtis Axel match on this show. We were told to vote on the app for the stipulation. Paul Heyman banned from ringside. Heyman as the guest referee, or Punk gets Heyman in the ring if he wins. 81% of you voted for Heyman to meet his death if Punk won, which he did. Heyman tried to bail. Security helped carry him back down to the ring. And what followed was, you know, all things considered, a pretty heavy angle. It was very very old school in a lot of ways. Curtis Axel, you know, there were points during this where Curtis Axel just kind of felt like he was there. It was really all about Punk and Heyman. The real feud here is Punk and Heyman, as it was before SummerSlam. I said it wasn't really about Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar was just there to be Heyman's hired hand. And it's much the same thing now with Curtis Axel. If Curtis Axel happens to come out of this a bigger star than he was at the beginning, then great. They've done nothing to make Curtis Axel look like a star. He's lost, you know, the one or two matches he already had with Punk, he's lost. He was made to look like a goober, laid out with the go-to-sleep. But Paul Heyman was absolutely fantastic here. Punk took a hell of a beating. He had welts all over his back. His back was bleeding when the angle was over. Axel was fine. But Heyman just kept whipping Punk in the chest and the ribs with a Singapore cane, saying, you know, I loved you. I was like a father figure to you. You broke my heart. He was weeping later on. They showed him backstage. His eyes were all red as though he was just crying. This was awesome, awesome stuff. And I don't really have much else to say about it. It's just a classic old-school wrestling angle. They played their parts really well. And again, I think a lot of people would pay money to see CM Punk get his hands on Paul Heyman and put him out. Take him out for good. Brie Bella beat Natalya. Divas Stopwatch had this at a minute 38, so it seems like we're regressing a little bit here with these Divas matches. They had all the girls from Total Divas were out there. I think they came out together. The baby faces came out together and the heels came out together. I think it was the Bellas with Eva Marie, and I think the Funkadactyls came out with Natalya. So the match ends, and then out comes AJ Lee on stage to drop, not a pipe bomb. I see people calling it a pipe bomb. I wouldn't call it a pipe bomb. I would call it an atomic bomb on the entire Divas division. She completely and utterly buried Total Divas, which is great because the show sucks. She went on to cut the best promo of her entire career. She said all she sees out there is a bunch of cheap, interchangeable, useless women. She made a reference to them giving blowjobs to people in power by saying that they sucked up to all the right people. And she paused after she said the word sucked. She said she's done in 1 year what none of these girls have been able to do in their entire careers, which is absolutely true. She said none of them could touch her, and then she skipped away. And the crowd cheered everything that she said. They gave her, she was the biggest baby face out there. And you know why? Because everything she said in this promo was true. That's why. I actually wanted to play the audio of what she said here, but I couldn't. Because the Bella Twins would not shut up over this entire thing. They were talking smack the whole time, talking over AJ. They would not shut up throughout this entire segment. I blame the production crew also for not cutting their mics during this. It looked like the Funkadactyls maybe were also spouting off at the mouth, but you couldn't hear what they were saying. You know, if they would have cut their mics, that would have solved the problem. You could show the Bellas getting angry and everything, but we wouldn't be able to hear them. But they kept their mics on. You know, and it's not the last time that the production crew would fuck up on this show either. We'll get to that in the main event. You know, I understand if you want to show them reacting, because in real life you wouldn't just stand there for 3 minutes and take that kind of abuse. Plus, I think they may have been filming some of this for the next season or whatever of Total Divas. But you know what? Say one or two things and shut the hell up. I wanted to put tape over their mouths. AJ, though, was tremendous here. Not even the Bellas could ruin this segment, even though they tried. They failed, but they certainly tried. Randy Orton pinned Christian with a thumb to the eye and an RKO. Match started out just a little slow. It's a little choppy. Not the best match the two of them have ever had, but these guys are two of the best, and so by the end they had the entire crowd eating up every near fall. Backstage, Daniel Bryan spray-painted the word YES all over Orton's new Escalade, which Michael Cole dubbed the YEScalade. Triple H was none too happy about this when he and Orton got back there to the car. He said he paid for it himself. He considered it his property. And then he uttered a very prophetic quote, Triple H did, when he said, "Just like I consider the WWE Championship belt my personal property, Randy Orton just holds it for me." That right there is a shoot. When I heard that, I was like, wow, that's quite the comment there for old Triple H to be scripted. Main event was the gauntlet match. All the superstars were out on stage per order of Triple H. They were all afraid to speak for fear of getting fired. I want to know what changed from 2 years ago when all the talent held a vote of confidence for Triple H and they walked out on him. Remember that? How come he didn't fire them then? What makes this so different? Anyway, Bryan and Rollins had a really fun match. This could be a championship feud someday in WWE, sometime in the next 2 years. I could see this. Bryan gave Rollins a sick-looking German superplex off the top rope. Yes, a German superplex. Can't say that I've seen too many of those. Rollins literally flipped. Just completely did a flip through the air, landed face down on the mat. And then Bryan nailed his running knee for the finish, except that the production team had a TNA moment, and instead of showing the finish, they showed a shot of the crowd chanting, "Yes." How the hell do you miss the finish of this match? How does that even happen? When they went to that crowd shot, because that's the thing they do. You know, Bryan backs up into the corner. He starts going, "Yes." They show the crowd, which looks great because you see all the people doing it. I got no problem with that. But I'm watching this, And when they go to that crowd shot, I'm timing it in my head. And I said, now, you know, switch the shot now. And instead, they missed the whole damn thing. I mean, that there's no excuse for that. I saw a fan video of the finish. Somebody uploaded it to YouTube. They were there. And Rollins did an amazing sell job on that knee. Apparently, WWE thought it was more important to show us an extended crowd shot and not bother with a replay, even though they replay entire segments of the show for us every single week. Dean Ambrose was next in the gauntlet. Bryan immediately put him in the yes slot. Roman Reigns ran in for the DQ. All three Shield members beat up Bryan. None of the babyfaces on stage helped. Shield beat up Bryan for Orton a little bit more. Orton gave him the RKO. Big Show was awesome here. The way he can tell a story with nothing more than his facial expressions is just tremendous. And as good as he was here, I thought he was incredible on SmackDown this week. But you know what? If this week shows us anything, it's that Daniel Bryan is more than capable of carrying things in John Cena's absence. And that final segment, too, on this show did really well. Like, I mean, it did really well. As in, it gained over a million viewers, which is amazing growth. So people are into the corporation angle. Whatever they're doing right now, it's working. You know, I see some people complaining about how Bryan keeps getting laid out. As long as they allow Bryan to stay competitive, which I assume, you know, even this week, he's got to come out and do something to get revenge. That it harkens back to the Austin McMahon stuff every week. You know, Vince McMahon would throw everything he could at Steve Austin. Every guy, whether it was Dude Love or he got in bed, so to speak, not literally, with The Undertaker, when they had the corporation going, he would throw guy after guy after guy. Austin would knock him down. And, you know, sometimes the corporation would get one over on Austin and leave him laying at the end of the show. And other weeks, Austin would embarrass Vince McMahon and would come out on a Zamboni or in a beer truck, or he would get McMahon arrested. Like, they would come up with these very creative angles and these very creative ways for one guy to one-up the other. So I have no problem with the way that they've done it so far because, again, the angle just started. It's normal for the heels to establish their dominance before the babyface ultimately triumphs in the end. So Bryan has to come out at some point. I think this week would be a good time for it and do something to get one over on Orton and Triple H and the rest of them. You can't just lay him out every single week because at some point that gets old. I figure a screw job at Night of Champions because it's just way too early for Bryan to get the belt back. And he could get it back at Hell in a Cell. You know, I think they have two pay-per-views in October this year. I think Hell in a Cell is actually later in the month. I don't remember. I think Battleground. Actually, I think Battleground is on my birthday. I think that's on the 6th of October. But maybe that Hell in a Cell pay-per-view later on in October would be a good time for Bryan to get the belt back. You know, and I wouldn't even mind it being a hot potato for a couple of months if they want to keep the feud going. You know, Rock and Mankind did it in early 99, although with them it reached the point of absurdity with all the different title changes they had. You don't need to have a CM Punk kind of champion, you know, all the time where this guy's got to hold the belt for, you know, a year or 7 or 8 months. You know, CM Punk was champion for, what, 434 days? Rock had it for a few months. And then John Cena was champion from WrestleMania until SummerSlam, which is a decent amount of time. So if they want to, you know, get the belt, let's say, back on Bryan and then have Bryan lose it back to Orton and go back and forth a couple of times, I got no problem with that. Because you can't have Bryan lose all the time. At some point, people are going to stop chanting yes, and they're going to say, hey, this guy can't get the job done. Let's, you know, cheer for CM Punk, or let's wait for John Cena to come back. That's not the answer. You know, SmackDown this week, I don't get a chance to watch SmackDown every single week. You know, even I have a limit. You know, I watch 3 hours of Raw Monday. I fit in NXT, Impact, and when I can, I fit in whatever else is worthwhile. But SmackDown just doesn't make my priority list every week. I watched SmackDown this week because I had read what happened and I wanted to see it. And I'm glad I did because SmackDown was the best wrestling show of the week. I thought it was a fantastic show just in terms of the main storyline. I mean, all the in-between stuff, you know, they had a match between RVD and Damian Sandow, which of course RVD won. So for those of you keeping track, Sandow loses again on Raw, loses again on SmackDown. Poor guy. But it was all about the main angle. And the show started with Miz TV, which, again, is hit or miss. I'm not the biggest Miz TV fan in the world, although the Miz TV with Bryan and Cena a few weeks ago was actually very good. They had Miz out there with Big Show, with Ziggler. They're talking about, you know, basically they're petrified to speak out of turn because their jobs are on the line. And Triple H came out. Triple H made what I think is a rare SmackDown appearance. I don't think he's made too many appearances on the show recently. And he was in full dick mode on the show. So if there was any debate at all about how big of a heel Triple H was, is he kind of in between? There is no in between. Triple H and Randy Orton were very well established, I think, on Raw, but especially on SmackDown this week. These guys are heels. You are not supposed to like these men. They are assholes. That came across big time on this show. Triple H, again, was out there. He was up in their faces. He told the Big Show, you're going to sit at ringside for the entire show. Every single match on the show, you're going to sit at ringside. You're not going to move. You're not going to say a word. And we can go back and forth on, again, what sense it makes for a guy that supposedly had an ironclad contract that he is so terrified, and he just sits there and he takes it and he doesn't do anything. But if you can ignore that for a second, because clearly they are, like I said earlier, Big Show was phenomenal on this show. The only thing Big Show ever said, he spoke a few short words during Miz TV, that was it. Otherwise, he said nothing. All he did was sit there the whole night, and they had a handicap match. The Shield beat up Dolph Ziggler again, and they're taunting Big Show. And they're like, come on, you know, come on in, do something about it. Camera gets all focused up on Big Show's face, and again, he tells a story with his face. It's just amazing to watch. I thought he was tremendous on this show. I can't say enough good things about Big Show's performance. And this is working. People are chanting Big Show's name. They wanted so badly for him to get in there and help Ziggler, to get in there and help Bryan, for him to beat everybody up, that when the day finally comes that the Big Show snaps, people are going to go nuts. They're going to go crazy. And hopefully when he finally snaps, it's Triple H who he knocks out. Because otherwise, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. You know, Bryan is the one feuding with Orton. I certainly would hope that they're not just using Bryan this way to set up the Big Show as the real number one contender for the title. I think that would be a huge mistake. Maybe when they get through with the Orton-Bryan matches, if Bryan doesn't win the belt, then they transition Bryan into feud temporarily with somebody else, and Big Show will get a title shot. Not win, but he'll get a title shot, and then they'll come back to Bryan. I don't know which direction they're going to go in. It would make sense, because then they could do Triple H and Bryan. I remain convinced that we're going to see that match at some point, and that Triple H is going to win. The rumor going around is that they may be building to a Big Show Triple H match, which I could see. And I wouldn't mind that. You know, as long as it doesn't disturb what they're doing with Bryan, you could take two, you know, legends if you want to in the company, like Triple H and Big Show, and let him have a match. I don't care. As long as it doesn't impact the main feud going on, I'm fine with that. And again, Big Show ought to knock Triple H out when all is said and done, because you'll get the biggest reaction that you could possibly hope for, I think, is the big knockout in the end. Bryan was super over on this show. He came out to make the save. There was a Miz-Randy Orton match. Randy Orton won. They were beating up the Miz. Bryan came out with a chair. Place went nuts. So Bryan has seemingly not been hurt by this. People are still very much into him, and they're chanting yes, and I watch closely, because when it comes to SmackDown, this is one of the reasons why I'm not a huge fan of SmackDown, even though the wrestling usually is really good. They take the crowd sweetening and the editing on this show to the point of absurdity sometimes. I feel like even if you have kind of a dead crowd, it would almost be better for them to just leave the show alone, but they sweeten the crowd. They make it so obvious. People are cheering, and they're jumping up and down. No, they're not jumping up and down. You hear all this noise, and they're sitting on their hands. And you know that it's fake, and you know that this crowd noise you're hearing is completely manufactured. And it drives me nuts. I didn't get any of that on this show. This looked like, I don't know if anybody listening was in the crowd for the tapings, but this crowd looked like a hot crowd, and I didn't really detect too much in the way of crowd sweetening. So I think that helped make the show more enjoyable. The end of the show, I'm sure many of you have probably seen the image of Daniel Bryan laying on the mat with the spray paint on his chest, Randy Orton spray painting the word no, people making reference to the fact that there was one initial missing from the spray paint. Very NWO-esque, the way they did this, but it made sense. I don't want to say they completely copied off the NWO, because the point was Bryan spray painted Orton's car, and so Orton decided to spray paint Bryan. Doesn't necessarily mean they stole it from the NWO, but you watch this angle, and it certainly takes you back to those days. Curtis Axel and Paul Heyman also had a promo on the show. It was mostly Heyman. Axel was okay. Axel really isn't all that good on the mic. So Heyman did most of the talking. Heyman was great. He pretty much admitted that, you know, CM Punk is probably going to kill me at Night of Champions, and all you people want to see it. But he's not running. He'll be there. Overall, I was very impressed by SmackDown. I thought it was a great show this week. I caught NXT again this week, so we'll do a quick run-through of this week's episode. Show opened with The Ascension. Backstage, they attacked Corey Graves, which set up the main event of Adrian Neville, who, of course, is Corey Graves' tag team partner, taking on Conor O'Brien. We had Tyler Breeze, my favorite NXT wrestler, up against CJ Parker. Breeze was angry here. He didn't come out like he normally does, taking pictures of himself, smiling and posing. He was not in a good mood. And he kept telling, you know, CJ Parker, again, he's the one who's been photobombing him every single week. And he tells Parker, do not touch my face. Do not touch my phone. Don't touch anything. I don't know why. I thought that was hilarious. You know, maybe he's got some OCD. That'd be a good gimmick for a wrestler, I think. A wrestler with obsessive compulsive disorder. So, like, if the skirt around the ring apron is all messed up, he just has to go over and fix it. You know, if there's a chair laying on the ground, he feels the need to pick it up and put it back where it belongs. If he's cutting a promo and he flubs a line, he has to start all over again from the beginning. Come on! It's a great idea. Fans were into Tyler Breeze, even though he's a heel. They were chanting, "You are gorgeous," at one point. That scared me a little. He won the match after nailing CJ Parker in the face with his iPhone behind the referee's back, and he got the pin. Emma beat Summer Rae with her Emma Lock. Emma is the number two babyface diva on NXT behind Paige. The two of them are the most popular. She is the number one contender to the Women's Championship. Summer Rae, I thought, actually looked pretty good here. She always looks good, but in the ring, she used this move I've never seen before, which is basically a full Nelson submission. She used her legs to apply it. She had Emma down on the mat. She locked her arms behind her, using nothing but her legs. It's pretty innovative. I've said before, you know, Summer Rae is a total bitch on this show, and she's great at it. She plays the role perfectly. So I've got nothing but praise for her as far as that goes. After the match, Emma is celebrating her win. Summer Rae grabs the bubble solution, because Emma loves to shoot bubbles during her entrance. She loves to blow them. That's part of her shtick. And she splashes the solution right in Emma's face like a sore loser. Emma's just writhing around on the ground. Her eyes are burning. I actually felt bad for her. They got me to hate Summer Rae for what she just did to this poor girl. So I enjoyed this. Enzo Amore against Sylvester LaForte's meal ticket, Scott Dawson. Amore and Colin Cassidy appear to both be babyfaces now, inexplicably. They were super over on this show. Amore did have this amusing line when he came out for his entrance where he said that if he and Cassidy had a dime for every time they got beaten up as kids, they'd have zero dimes. And just the way that he delivered it with that thick, you know, New Jersey accent, it was pretty funny. For the finish, Alexander Rusev, the big Bulgarian dude who wrestled Dolph Ziggler last week. And by the way, I was alerted by one of our Bulgarian fans that last week I mistakenly referred to Rusev as Hungarian instead of Bulgarian. So I apologize for that. The Bulgarian ran down to ringside. He attacked Colin Cassidy on the outside, which distracted Enzo Amore, and you can pretty much figure out what happened next. Dawson nails him with a suplex, gets the pin. Afterwards, Sylvester LaForte celebrates on stage with both Dawson and Rusev, so it appears LaForte has signed the big guy to his budding stable of talent. It's odd enough seeing LaForte, who is a Frenchman, managing a redneck, and now he's got a Bulgarian, too. That's quite the international posse that he's building up there. Renee Young is in the ring next to interview Sami Zayn, who gets showered with chants of Match of the Year for his battle last week with Antonio Cesaro. Tony Dawson once again mentioned that Michael Cole said that it was the best match he had seen in years. So Sami Zayn says his focus now is on winning the NXT title. That brings out Bo Dallas, the NXT champion, who we are told was injured in a match with Sami Zayn during SummerSlam Access. I think the injury is legit. I don't know what it was. If it's some sort of leg injury or an arm injury, I have no idea. They didn't disclose what it was unless I missed it. Dallas, by the way, is a total heel now. There's no ambiguity about it. He is A guy who pretends the people love him, but they actually boo him out of the building. He says, they're not booing me, they're bowing me. This guy. Zeb Coulter made his way out. He demanded to see Sami Zayn's proof of citizenship. They go back and forth a little bit. Jack Swagger attacks Sami Zayn from behind out of the crowd. He left him laying. I heard Sami Zayn and Jack Swagger had a match at the most recent set of NXT tapings that was off the charts. People saying it's as good or close to as good as the match with Cesaro, so I can't wait to see that match if that's the case. It's not too late to bring Sami Zayn to the main roster, I think, and build to something on TV with him and Cesaro and give those two guys a chance to go out there at WrestleMania and steal the show. I'd love to see it. Those two guys in a WrestleMania match where they realize they're out there, the biggest match of their careers in front of, 75,000 people. I can only imagine the kind of match those two guys would have. Main event was Adrian Neville against Conor O'Brien. I thought it was interesting in the SummerSlam Access recap that they showed. They showed a video package. They had a soundbite where John Cena praised Adrian Neville. He singled him out specifically and had nothing but praise for the guy. So, can't be a bad thing for his career. Then again, Cena once said that he saw Ted DiBiase as a potential WrestleMania opponent for himself within the next 2 or 3 years. And that was 5 years ago. And this week, DiBiase announced he was leaving WWE to pursue other things. Just goes to show you, you could have all the potential in the world, but unless you can get the right people behind you, potential is just a word. O'Brien had to sell quite a bit in this match, which he has not done much of, given that every Ascension match up to this point has largely consisted of him and Rick Victor just squashing their opponents. All in all, I thought he looked pretty good. Neville always looks good in the ring. He won clean with his Red Arrow corkscrew shooting star. After the match, Ascension ganged up on him until Corey Graves. His ribs were all taped up from the backstage attack earlier. He came down for the save. Wasn't much of a save because he was hurt, so he got beaten down too. And that was pretty much it. So not the most exciting edition of NXT, but nothing was going to be after last week's main event. You kind of need a come-me-down show, and that's what this was. And now I guess we build to the Sami Zayn-Jack Swagger match. And never have I looked forward to a Jack Swagger match more than this. And in other news out of developmental, several superstars got their new NXT names this week. We had Sean Ricker, who was formerly from Championship Wrestling from Hollywood. He was the last man managed by the late Percy Pringle. And he also appeared on The Rock's reality show, The Hero. He has been renamed Slate Randall. Can't really say I'm a fan of that name at all, but could be worse. I think Ricker is going to be a big star. You search out some of his promo work on YouTube. He's got quite a bit of it on there, especially the stuff from Championship Wrestling from Hollywood. His look, his presence, his cadence, the way he speaks. I think Percy Pringle was managing him, and I think he had nothing but glowing things to say about him before his death. I think this guy's going to be a big star. That name certainly won't help, but I think he's going to be somebody to watch out for. Sami Callihan, who I know many of you are familiar with, he wrestled all over the place. CZW, Ring of Honor a little bit, Evolve, Dragon Gate USA. He is now going by the name Solomon Crowe. And for reasons, of course, that make me completely biased, I don't think that's a bad name at all. Can't go wrong with Solomon Crowe. Samurai Del Sol, who has wrestled in AAA, CZW, also Evolve and Dragon Gate and some places like that, he is now going by the name Kalisto. And it's funny because, before I heard about Samurai Del Sol's real name, new name, I should say, that would be a pretty cool real name, but that's not his real name. Before I heard his new name, I was hearing, Slate Randall and Solomon Crowe and some of the other names they've given these guys, and I was thinking to myself, boy, what happened to the days where you can get like a really cool gimmick name that didn't sound like a real name? Like, most of the names they give out now are meant to be real names. It's a first name and a last name. But what happened to like some of those old names? Like, again, you had tag teams like Demolition with guys like Hawk and Animal, Axe and Smash. I just think names like that, you need more of that in wrestling. But then I heard the name Kalisto, and Kalisto's pretty cool. That's certainly a step in the right direction. But still, not everybody has been so lucky with their NXT names. Adrian from Australia wrote into the show this week. He says, earlier this year I emailed you about NXT's newest signee, an Australian heavyweight named Matt Silva. At the time I was raving to you about this pickup. Well, this past week he was given his new name along with everybody else, and he was saddled he was saddled with the name Buddy Murphy. He says, some drug addict behind the scenes watched The Nutty Professor with the character Buddy Love, played by Eddie Murphy, and decided that it would be a fantastic name. I'm sorry. It would be a fantastic name to give this heavyweight ass kicker from Down Under. Well, I gotta say, Buddy Murphy's pretty bad. That's a pretty bad name, especially if I haven't seen what this guy looks like. I should probably Google him, this Matt Silva guy, but if he is this big ass-kicking type guy that you say he is, I must admit, Buddy Murphy is not a name that will help him. So, yeah, I don't know what to say. Some of the names weren't that bad. Buddy Murphy I would not put in that same category. TNA. This is where the fun ends here. I played the audio at the beginning of the show. That was from the Toronto Fan Expo. Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff had a Q&A session. They took part, I think it was called Hulk Hogan Uncensored. It's a special event. And Hogan was asked about a potential WWE return. He pointed out to never say never in the pro wrestling business, which, I mean, what other answer do you really expect him to give? And then he was asked what it was going to take to make TNA successful. And that's the audio you heard earlier. Hogan said, in a perfect world, Eric Bischoff needed to be given the keys to the car, and that somebody somewhere needed to drop all the resources we need like we had in WWE, whether it be cameras or money or vehicles or advertising. So basically, Hogan's grand idea is to officially turn TNA into WCW. Just give Bischoff all the power and Ted Turner's checkbook again and watch the magic happen. After 3.5 years, that's Hulk Hogan's master plan for how to turn TNA around. Now, forget the fact I mentioned this a few weeks ago. Hulk Hogan's big idea that he had once upon a time for TNA was to have the fans go around and video record the wrestlers in their natural habitat outside the ring, if they're, you know, going through an airport, if they're in a restaurant or wherever, videotape that and send the footage into TNA. That was another grand idea that Hulk Hogan once had. He thought that was going to revolutionize the business. So here we are after 3 years of nothing, 3 years of stagnation. And we should give these guys more power. What must Dixie Carter be thinking when she hears this? I mean, I'm no defender of Dixie, but what an insult for this guy to go out there and tell people, yeah, you know, the problem with TNA is that they won't give Eric more power. Things would be so much better if Dixie and everybody else would just get the hell out of the way and let him do his thing. Eric Bischoff has been very successful as a producer when it comes to television. He has his Bischoff Hervey entertainment company. He's working with all different kinds of networks at any given moment. You know, they seem to be doing very well. But I chuckle whenever somebody writes into me talking about what a great creative visionary Eric Bischoff was in WCW. Bischoff had some good ideas, but boy, that gets overstated to the nth degree. He struck gold with the NWO idea. I'll give him that. It was an idea that he first saw in Japan. He adapted it. He used it here in this country. And it was a massive success. At least until they watered it down. And yes, he gave life to the cruiserweight division, which brought a nice balance to all the old guys and all the ex-WWF guys on Nitro. Brought a lot of energy. You weren't allowed to get over beyond a certain level if you were a cruiserweight. I mean, look at Chris Jericho. Look at Eddie Guerrero. Why do you think those guys left? Because they loved WCW so much? Bullshit. It's because they weren't getting any opportunities. They bonked their head on the so-called glass ceiling and they almost knocked themselves out. Once they left, they became much bigger names than they were in WCW. You have Goldberg. The one truly big-time star that company ever made in the late 90s was Bill Goldberg. DDP... You know, DDP got himself over, but he wasn't the same big-name star that Goldberg was. I mean, he was a big star, but Goldberg for them was the man. Goldberg was it. He was the only guy they really made during that time. And it's a miracle they let that streak go on for as long as they did before they fucked it up. So what else? That's two things I named. Three things, maybe. I want more examples. You know, Bischoff went to Ted Turner. He was shocked when he agreed to give him time on Monday nights, but he got it. Okay, he had Turner backing him. He had Turner's money to go out and buy up all the old WWF guys. I don't fault him for it. I mean, it worked. It worked for him. But guess what? That perfect world that Hulk Hogan is talking about doesn't exist. It exists in your head. You can give Eric Bischoff all the power you want. But when he doesn't have Ted Turner as his ally, and he doesn't have that blank check to sign whoever the hell he wants, what evidence is there that Eric Bischoff can be creative and crafty enough to turn TNA around? I mean, what evidence is there? There is none. It's Hogan sticking up for his buddy, which, let's be honest here, in reality, it's Hogan looking out for his own ass because he knows that how tight he is with Eric. And if Eric gets full power, then Hulk's got it made. In the end, it's all about Hulk Hogan. So if that's his answer, then all it does is show that these guys have no real plan. They're just out for themselves. I mean, we already knew this. I know. We're not breaking any new ground here. We just have proof now in Hogan's own words. And if you're a TNA fan, boy, you know, you should be frightened by that. And angry. Because these guys have no vision. They have no plan. All they have are memories of a company that they helped run into the fucking ground 15 years ago. That's it. That's all they have. So, we have Impact this week, which was a live show from Cleveland, Ohio. Had some good wrestling. Austin Aries and Christopher Daniels had a really good match. The only thing worth watching on this show, the one positive about the Aces and Eights stuff, I will say, is that it's finally coming to an end. I don't know if it's going to be a Bound for Glory and maybe a little after that, but the seeds have been planted. There is dissension in the ranks, and nobody could be happier about that than I am. This Aces and Eights storyline started over a year ago. It was June of last year when Sting got attacked for the first time by those guys in masks. I can honestly say the only thing I've liked about the angle is that it gave Bully Ray a chance to shine. It gave him a chance to be a main event player. A guy who's been in the wrestling business for probably almost 20 years. After all that time, he finally had a chance to go out there as a singles guy, not a tag team wrestler, and show what he's made of. You know, and I think that's pretty cool. But what about everybody else in that group? What new stars have been made by being part of Aces and Eights? Doc was the closest thing they had to a guy who might actually come out of it looking stronger and getting over as a babyface, and then they let his contract lapse. Are Garrett Bischoff and Wes Briscoe any more of a star now than they were before? They're lucky to even be employed. Nux? Forget Nux. Nux is just a guy. Mr. Anderson, who I actually thought was really good on this week's show. You better save this episode for posterity because it's the only time you're ever going to hear me praise The Miz and Mr. Anderson on the same show. I thought Miz was actually pretty good in his role on SmackDown, and Anderson was pretty good on Impact this week. You know, he toned the obnoxiousness way down. He played his role well. I normally can't stand the guy, but this week he was good. He's still not a star. D-Von is gone. Who else is there? That's it. So if the goal wasn't to make any new stars, which is fine. I mean, not every faction has to make a new star, but okay, fine. Let's say that's not the goal. Then they should at least be entertaining. Does anybody in the world think Aces and Eights is actually entertaining in any way? They're the cure for insomnia. And from the moment this angle started, it was a failure because nobody could take them seriously. Because they were booked to lose every single match that they were in. Some people may not remember that. It was like comedy after a while. You know, like the gang that can't shoot straight. They lost almost every single match that they were in on TV. Every single week. After all that, who could take them seriously? How do you start an angle like that by having these guys lose? So I, for one, am happy to see Bully and Anderson having problems because at least I know the end is finally in sight. Unfortunately, there wasn't much else to like on this show, and the reason for that can be summed up in five words. The Bound for Glory series. This entire show was built around two things, okay? The return of Hulk Hogan to Impact. He was gone for a month. I hardly even noticed, but apparently he was gone for an entire month. And the Bound for Glory series. They called it Must Win Thursday this week. And it sure looks like they've been forced to rush the finish of this tournament. I mean, who knows? TNA is claiming they never said that everybody in the tournament would be required to face each other at least once. All I know is some guys had more matches than others. That seems awfully unfair to me. If we're supposed to really invest in this and get excited about the Bound for Glory series and this tournament, you know, to do that, it just takes you right out of it. It's like, what the hell is the point of all this? You know, you had Magnus, who wasn't even on the show. He came into the night with 39 points. Joe Park, Hernandez, and Jay Bradley were way down at the bottom. They were already eliminated, mathematically eliminated. So they go and they do these matches. Jeff Hardy pins Kazarian for 7 points. And in doing so, he also used the worst figure four leg lock I think I've ever seen. He made The Miz look like Jack Briscoe here. That's how bad this looked. AJ Styles pinned Bobby Roode with an inside cradle. And he looked upset when he did that because he realized that he was still behind Chris Daniels in terms of points. And Austin Aries pinned Daniels in the best match of the night. He pinned him with the Brainbuster. So we were told then that the final four were Magnus, Hardy, Roode, and Aries. Okay, that's it. Those guys go to No Surrender in 2 weeks. They have some matches. We find out who the number one contender is at Bound for Glory. I was pretty surprised at that point because I figured, okay, you know, Daniels is going to get DQ'd in his match because if you get DQ'd, you lose 2 points, and that's how AJ Styles gets into the final four. Because all along, I figured Styles is winning the entire thing. It just fits perfectly into the storyline. You know, AJ comes back as the savior of TNA. He lost a match last year that said he can't get a title shot for a year. That year is almost up. So I figured that's where they were going. But whatever, Daniels lost clean to Aries, no DQ or anything like that, so Styles is out. But this is wrestling. Things aren't supposed to make sense. And at the end of the show, Hulk Hogan comes out, and he proceeds to announce that next week there's going to be one more match in the Bound for Glory series, a gauntlet match with all 12 men in the series. Now, why Jay Bradley and Hernandez are in there was not explained, because even if either one of them win, they still don't have enough points to qualify, so that's a complete waste. But anyway, Hogan says the winner gets 20 points and one last chance to make the final four. Then what the hell was the point of the entire tournament? If in the end, all you need to do is win one big match and you're in. So basically, the last 3 months have been a colossal waste of time. And that right there is why this was a bad show. The whole show was built around a tournament that isn't worth the frickin' toilet paper that they wipe their asses with. Is it really that difficult to book a tournament? I mean, I like the concept. In theory, it makes matches that might not otherwise mean anything actually mean something. Especially, you know, they're doing it at the live events. I went to the TNA show in Brooklyn back in July. They had a Bound for Glory series match. Yeah, if you're a fan there, it's kind of cool to think that this match at this live event that isn't even on TV, you know, the outcome actually matters. I like that concept. I like that idea. But in the end, it really doesn't mean anything. And it's like, why the hell should we even care? It's not like this is the first time they've done one of these. This is the third year they're doing this Bound for Glory series, and they still can't get it right. As if that isn't bad enough, we have Hogan at the end of the show. He tells Bully Ray that he's forcing him to defend his title in 2 weeks against a member of the Aces of Eights. And that's what he called them, so don't look at me. It's like when he calls Joe Park Joseph Parks. And then Hogan announces that this week, he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against Sting. Yes, the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he could never again get another title shot. Ever. So out comes Sting. He brawls with Bully a bit. And just like that, they go off the air. What in the fuck just happened? It took me a while to digest everything that was said by Hogan in this segment. And then I figured, okay, well, he had to have just flubbed his lines. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time he's done that. There's this great classic outtake from SmackDown that I posted on my Twitter between him and Vince McMahon where Hogan flubs his lines like 3 or 4 different times and he calls himself gay by accident. It's hilarious. And that was 10 years ago. The guy's 60 years old now. The mind is finally going. So sure enough, it turns out that Hogan messed everything up. He was supposed to say next week, not this week. And the match is, in fact, not for the championship. What a disaster this segment was. And what does Hogan really add to the show at this point, I guess would be my question. He can't wrestle. He forgets his lines. Everything still revolves around the guy. I don't understand what he brings to the table anymore that would justify the money they have to be paying him. I mean, what is it? What do they think he can do for them at this point? What is he doing for them in terms of licensing or video games or, you know, sticking his name on something, right? You would think, okay, the Hulk Hogan name means something. That's why it's so valuable for him to be here. Not really. I mean, what is he doing for them? What's the end game here? What does Hulk Hogan do for TNA? Maybe somebody can answer that question for me because I have absolutely no idea at this point what sense it makes to keep this guy around other than, hey, it's cool to say we have Hulk Hogan under contract. I just don't get it. We also had an AJ Styles promo on this show. Some people liked it. I saw some refer to it as a pipe bomb. Well, you got the bomb part right. I thought this sucked. It wasn't even the best promo by somebody named AJ this week. Not the best time for a promo like this when you're trying to negotiate a new deal for more money. This won't help his case. Styles was rambling. He was stumbling over his words. There were these long, awkward pauses where the crowd was just completely silent. Put it this way. When the Main Event Mafia offered Styles a spot and he came out, people were hot for the guy, you know, like they were last week when he went back to his old gimmick and his old theme music. People went crazy for him. They were cheering for him when he first came out here. By the end of this promo, they were chanting boring. Some fans were even chanting wrap it up, which was hilarious. If only Billy Ray Cyrus had taken that advice 20 years ago. I doubt very much that was the goal of this segment, was to get people to turn on AJ Styles. I think a lot of people heard the line where Styles said, I'm better than the best in the world, I'm the phenomenal AJ Styles, which was clearly meant to get people talking as a dig at CM Punk, playing off the rumors of him possibly leaving the company, which, by the way, he's not. I said last week, at the end of the day, my gut tells me he ain't going to go anywhere. And the reports out say that he has signed a short-term contract through Bound for Glory to give the two sides more time to negotiate a longer-term deal. I would still be shocked if he went anywhere. I think he's staying put in TNA. But I heard, you know, I think people heard that line and they immediately thought, ooh, you know, how edgy. Or we're going to see Punk vs. Styles in WWE if he leaves. So they automatically think, oh, what a great promo. That doesn't make it a good promo. He talked about having trust issues over the past year, not trusting the guys in the truck for airing his dirty laundry with all the Claire Lynch stuff without even consulting him to see if any of it was true. He said the only person he could trust was Alan Jones. And judging by the crowd's silence, I'm guessing 99% of these people have absolutely no idea who the hell he was referring to. Crowd started chanting, yes. Then they started with the what treatment, and I'm not going to count that against him. You know, I'm not saying it's a bad promo because the fans didn't cooperate. It was a bad promo because it was a bad promo. The fans just happened to crap all over it. But when it comes to the what chants, I'm not going to count that against AJ. The people who do that are mentally challenged. It's not his fault. But still, it's embarrassing. You know, he talked about the people being able to relate to what it's like having a job that sucks. Talked about being shafted by upper management. He yelled at Dixie Carter that he deserves better. For some reason, he yelled at the same thing at Mike Tenay at ringside. He said there's been many times over the past year he prayed to God that he would be fired so that he wouldn't have to quit. I'm sure there are others in TNA who probably feel the exact same way. He just came across as a crybaby during this promo. I mean, it's no wonder the people turned on him. He said he's come to realize that he likes being the go-to guy, the guy they can depend on. He wondered if he can be that guy again and become the TNA World Champion. It's just incredible to watch the progression from enthusiasm to apathy for this guy in the span of 5 minutes. There was another match on this show, miraculously, that had absolutely nothing to do with the Bound for Glory series. It was a 2 out of 3 falls match between ODB and Gail Kim. Kim got the tap out for the first fall. ODB won the second with an inside cradle. And she won the third with a Texas Cloverleaf for the submission. So ODB is your new number one contender. She will challenge Mickie James for the Knockouts title at, I would assume, No Surrender. Although I don't know if they said that. They also had a backstage segment where they asked Velvet Sky why she wasn't at Hardcore Justice. She said she missed it for personal reasons. And then this mystery interviewer who we couldn't see asked her if it had anything to do with her relationship with Chris Sabin. And she acknowledged that they've been together for a long time, but she keeps business and personal separate. So I guess that'll be a direction for Sabin soon, putting him together with Velvet on TV. Not a bad consolation prize. I would trade the TNA title for Velvet Sky. I would trade all of TNA for Velvet Sky, personally. And then there's the Aries and Daniels main event. Really, really good match. Go find it and watch it. I didn't hate everything on this show. I found something enjoyable. But yeah, this was not a good week for Impact. Actually, these past several weeks have been very uninspiring. You'll always find some good wrestling on Impact, but the storytelling, I think, has been horrendous. There just isn't anything really to care about, and there's really nobody to get behind. AJ Styles should be that guy, and maybe he will be. But after this week, I'd be very concerned. By the way, they had a house show last night in Woodstock, Virginia, advertising an AJ Styles versus Bully Ray match for the TNA World title, apparently forgetting their own storyline where AJ is not allowed to get a title shot for up to a year. And when they finally realized that they fucked up, they changed the match to Magnus challenging for the title instead. I wonder how long in advance they made that match, or it took them until the day of the show to realize the mistake and then change it. But they did change it, so I give them credit for that. Let's go for the mailbag here. If you have any questions, you can always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. If you have audio questions that you want to send into the show, please send them in MP3 format only, give or take about 30 seconds long. And please include the question in written form in the body of your email. There were a few people this week who did not do that. This week's audio question comes to us from TJ, and appropriately, it concerns AJ Styles.
TJ here. I want to ask you about AJ Styles leaving TNA. Where would you like to see AJ Styles wrestle? And if he, by any chance, go to WWE, would we see AJ Styles winning the WWE Championship or wrestling dream matches against John Cena and CM Punk?
In a perfect world, the same perfect world I guess that Hulk Hogan was talking about, I would like to see AJ Styles stay in TNA, let them re-sign him, give him the deal that he deserves. He is the face of that company. He's been with them from the beginning. He's made a name for himself there. He seems to be happy enough there. He stayed with them for so long. Stay with TNA and just do his thing there. If he wants to make more money or he wants to be a bigger star, then he would go to WWE. But I don't know that that's what AJ Styles wants. If he were to go to WWE, do I think he would win the championship? I don't think so. But I think, yeah, would he feud with Cena and Punk? I think it's safe to say he would feud with them. And I could see AJ Styles and Randy Orton. I think they could have some good matches too. Any of those three guys, I think, against AJ, you'd get some really great matches. But like I said earlier, he has signed a short-term deal to stay with the company for at least another month. And then I guess that'll give them some more time to negotiate a longer-term deal if they can give him whatever money he's looking for. I think in the end, they'll reach a deal. He'll stay with TNA. And that's probably where he's going to finish his career. This comes from Evil Evan out of Southern California. I still want to know what's so evil about the guy. He seems like a nice enough guy to me. We all know WWE has a long list of great superstars to never hold the title, like Roddy Piper, Jake Roberts, and Mr. Perfect. My question is, if TNA were to shut down today, who would be on the list of great TNA talent to never hold their title? I would say Fallen Angel Christopher Daniels, but would love to know your thoughts. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would go with Daniels, too. He's certainly talented enough, and in the last, I'd say, year and a half, he's been more entertaining, I think, than at any other point during his entire career. I think he's great, especially him and Kazarian together. Really, there's nobody else I can think of. Everybody of any note has held the TNA or NWA world title, depending on how far back in TNA you want to go. Sting, Angle, Bully, Styles, Aries, they gave him a shot with the belt. Rude, Storm had it, although he only had it for a little while. Saban, who I never would have expected to be a world champion. Samoa Joe, who probably should be the world champion again. Maybe Magnus will have it one day. I don't think there's anybody else but Daniels, so I would agree. Abdul from Portland, Oregon. What do you think will be done about the Intercontinental Championship at Night of Champions? Right now we have a 2-on-1 handicap match with Punk against Heyman and Axel, but the title is not on the line. Do you think the title will be on the line, or will Axel lose it before the pay-per-view? My idea is to put the title on the line, and since it's an elimination match, Punk can eliminate Heyman first, and then Axel can beat Punk. That way Axel retains, and Punk gets his hands on Heyman. How do you feel about this? I actually think that's a hell of an idea. I would prefer that they debut a new Paul Heyman guy during the match, whether it's Ryback or whoever they're going to pick. But I actually really like your idea. Axel is, let's say, incapacitated. Punk gets his hands on Heyman. He beats him. Axel comes in, gets a big win over Punk, maybe with some help from the new Paul Heyman guy. Axel really needs a win here, I think, because Punk has beaten him at every turn, and there are very few people that take Curtis Axel seriously as a threat. I think a big pay-per-view win over CM Punk would go a long way to helping him. Simon from Norwich, England, an NXT-based question for you this week. It's the best hour of wrestling on TV. My question relates to the Ascension. I like the idea of the act, and although I'm not the biggest Conor O'Brien fan in the world, The team in its original incarnation worked very well with Kenneth Cameron. I felt the main roster appearance was imminent. We all know what happened with Cameron. He's gone. I can't help but feel that Rick Victor is the wrong man for the job. It feels like the Ascension Light. What are your thoughts on this team? Would you have picked someone else for the job? I only started watching NXT consistently about 3 months ago, so I didn't really see as much of Kenneth Cameron as part of the group as maybe you did. I barely remember the guy, so to me, Rick Victor is fine. You know, he's a guy that was seemingly going nowhere on his own. They weren't really doing anything with him. So for him, it's probably a good thing they plugged him in there. I don't have a problem with him. You know, after they fired Cameron, I was thinking Leo Kruger might be a good fit for the team. Not that his current character was a good fit, per se. He'd have to undergo some sort of transformation. But I think he would have worked well. On his own, I don't know that Leo Kruger is anything more than just a mid-card guy at best. Why not change up his character a bit and plug him into a team that could really do something on the main roster? But I'm not saying they should do that now. I think Rick Victor is fine, but Leo Kruger was the first name that popped in my head when I thought, okay, who could they put with Conor O'Brien? Because Conor O'Brien is a single. They had him as a singles guy for a few weeks. Boy, that he was going nowhere. Okay, we need more tag teams. I think if you're part of a tag team, it actually works to your benefit now. Let's say if they're promoting you from NXT, because they've tried to put some more focus on the tag team division recently. They're trying to anyway. We have more teams now than we have probably at any other point in the last few years. I think that's a good thing. And at some point, when the time comes, you can kind of break away from that and become a singles guy. But we have enough singles guy already. So Conor O'Brien by himself or Rick Victor by themselves, I don't think that really does anything for those two guys. I think together is a better situation for them to be in. This comes from Chad. Do you really think there's any possibility WWE lets DDP, Scott Hall, and Jake Roberts have an in-ring segment at WrestleMania 30 just to celebrate the progress they have made over the past year? They could even show a video package so people who are unaware of the story can get a sense of their journey. This is all dependent, of course, on Jake and Scott remaining clean and sober. No, WrestleMania is not celebrity rehab. Okay, that's not the place for something like this. If they want to put any of those guys in the Hall of Fame, then they'll get their WrestleMania moment on stage with the rest of the inductees. If they want to have Jake as a surprise entrant in the Royal Rumble, I think that's great. I'm happy they're doing so well, but WrestleMania is not the time for one big group hug. Chad has a second question. What are your thoughts on the Beyond the Mat documentary? I really liked it. That documentary came out, I want to say, back in 99. Probably 99. So if you haven't seen it, you could find it on YouTube. I know at least at one point the full documentary was accessible on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, it's kind of depressing. But if you want a real behind-the-scenes look at WWE, forget that Total Divas garbage. Watch this documentary. The access that they gave Barry Blaustein is pretty incredible before. You know, of course, what ended up happening is when the movie was finished, he showed a copy of it to Vince and Linda. And at that point, they did everything in their power to make sure nobody would see it. They wouldn't air commercials for it during Raw. They did absolutely nothing to support it at that point. They hated the movie. But that probably is an indication of how good it is, because it actually is a very real, raw look at the careers of Mick Foley, Terry Funk, and Jake Roberts. At the time, Jake was a mess. Funk is a crazy man. Mick is probably just as crazy. They have the whole sequence of events during the 99 Royal Rumble and the chair shots and everything and the reaction of his family and his kids, they're crying. It's pretty intense stuff. So if you've never seen Beyond the Mat before, you probably will enjoy it. Just be aware it's not the most uplifting movie in the world. You won't come away from it necessarily thinking, oh, what a wonderful business the wrestling business is. Personally, I think the real draw of the documentary is you've got Dennis Stamp jumping on a trampoline. I mean, really, what more could you ask for? This question is from Justin. I just started listening to your podcast and enjoy your Week in Wrestling History segments. I wanted to know your thoughts on the Hogan vs. Sting main event at Starrcade 1997. I remember watching the match and watching Hogan hit the leg drop on Sting and then proceed to pin him cleanly for the three count. Like many others that night, I was confused as to what had happened. What do you think went wrong with the finish? I don't know that we're ever going to know the full truth about what happened that night with the finish. Sting had not wrestled a match for over a year. I mean, when you really think about the Sting angle and the way they handled it and built it up to that one Starrcade pay-per-view, There's a reason why that Starrcade was the best performing pay-per-view WCW ever did. They did a tremendous job of building up to the Hogan Sting match, and the match itself was a complete dud. And the reason it was a complete dud, besides the finish, if you go back and watch that match, Hogan probably took like 90% of it. I mean, Sting got in a few moves, I think, at the beginning, but for the most part, that match consisted of Hulk Hogan just beating the crap out of Sting. Now, it's one thing if you're going to build a match where, let's say, the heel is going to just beat the shit out of the babyface, but in the end, the babyface has the big comeback and then he wins. But that's not what happened here. Hogan beat Sting around for the entire match, and when it came time for the big finish, like you said, he dropped the leg and he pinned him. 1, 2, 3. Now, what happened is it was supposed to be a fast count finish because they sent Bret Hart out there, Bret Hart, who had just signed with WCW. This was his first pay-per-view appearance. He went out there. He went out there largely to chastise the referee because the referee was supposed to count fast. So, you know, Bret's out there. I'm not going to let this happen, you know, basically because he got screwed. I'm not going to let somebody else get screwed. And he knocked out Nick Patrick. The only problem is you're watching this and going, boy, what a prick Bret Hart is. He just beat up an innocent referee. All the referee did was count three. He did his job. He didn't do anything wrong. So something happened with the count. Nick Patrick should have counted fast, and he didn't. And the rumors are that Hulk Hogan may have had something to do with that. It just so happens that Hogan went out there. Hogan looked great. He beat Sting up for most of the match. And Hogan can say, hey, I pinned Sting cleanly. The fact that we're still talking about the finish of this match all these years later is proof of exactly what Hulk Hogan was probably looking to get out of it. All that people remember is that Hogan cleanly beat Sting. They built this match up for over a year, and in the end, the heel beat the babyface 1, 2, 3. Did Hogan pay off the referee? Did he say something to Nick Patrick? Nobody knows. It's pure speculation, but I think it's a fair assumption to make that Hogan probably had something to do with that finish going down the way it did. Finally here, Matt writes in, when discussing controversial wrestling angles, you've stated numerous times that you are not easily offended by wrestling storylines. However, has there ever been an angle that has seriously offended you? Not really offended. I mean, there have been a ton that have made me shake my head because of how tasteless they were. I mean, there's been a ton of angles that have made me question why I watch wrestling in the first place. You know, the Dr. Heine skit that Vince McMahon did when he mocked Jim Ross the day after JR had serious colon surgery. Stuff like that. You know, the angle they did with Road Warrior Hawk back in 98 when they played off his real-life problems with booze. And they'd have him come to the ring stumbling drunk. He was rambling on commentary. He was incoherent. And then they had Draws push him off the Titantron. That was pretty stupid. Same thing in WCW. They incorporated Scott Hall's drinking problems into the storyline as well. Nothing's really ever offended me to where I said, you know, screw this, I'm not watching this anymore. But the one thing that really made my skin crawl was after Eddie Guerrero died. You know, the Eddie's in Hell stuff was pretty bad, but it wasn't even that. You know, that was some stupid storyline they came up with to get Rey Mysterio over as a bigger star. After Eddie died on WWE.com or WWEshop.com, whichever one it was, they were advertising markdown prices on all Eddie Guerrero merchandise, and they had this big banner that said, Viva La Savings. I just remember sitting there thinking, are you fucking kidding me? Viva La Savings? Who thought that was a good idea? That was the one that maybe made me the most angry. I still remember that. I just said, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe they actually did that. Aside from that, I can't really say there's ever been an angle that's truly offended me. I just, you know, wrestling is what it is. I mean, we can bitch and moan about how stupid some of the stuff is, but nothing they've ever done has made me go, oh, I can't watch this anymore. And if the Katie Vick stuff didn't get me to stop watching, I doubt anything ever will. History has been made here! This week in wrestling history, which is quickly becoming my favorite segment of the show, ton of SummerSlams to talk about happening this week in history. August 29th being a very important date. Three different SummerSlams, including the very first, were held on that date. In 1988, at Madison Square Garden, the Honky Tonk Man's 14-month reign as the Intercontinental Champion, still the longest of all time, came to an end in a mere 30 seconds at the hands of a surprise opponent, the Ultimate Warrior. Honky was scheduled to defend the title against Brutus the Barber Beefcake, But Beefcake was injured in storyline. They did a storyline deal with him and Outlaw Ron Bass. So he was out, and Warrior won the championship. And Warrior never really lost the championship, I guess. I mean, he lost it to Rick Rude, won it back. But when he won the WWF title at WrestleMania 6, they stripped him of the belt and put it up at a tournament. So in the end, he never really lost it. In 1992, SummerSlam emanated from Wembley Stadium in London, England, the last big WWE pay-per-view to be held over in the UK. One of the main reasons, if not the main reason, they have not returned since is the time zone difference. This show actually took place on August 29th. It did not air in the US until the 31st. And back then, you know, there was no internet, there were no smartphones like we have today where the results of the show would be known probably before the show was even over. They claimed 80,355 fans for the event, which in theory would put it at number 3 all time behind the 93,000 for WrestleMania 3. But that number has been in dispute for years. It goes back to Dave Meltzer, I think, claimed once that he had a conversation with Zane Breslov. Zane Breslov was the promoter for WWF at that time in Michigan. He was helping to promote that event. He was also a promoter later on for WCW. He sent Meltzer a fax of the official statement from the Silver Dome that listed the actual attendance for WrestleMania 3 as 78,000. So, you know, we can't ask Breslov because he died in a car accident 10 years ago. The number 2 attendance in WWE land would be this year's WrestleMania. In MetLife Stadium, they claimed 80,676 fans. But I remember reading a few months ago that a rep from MetLife said the actual attendance was 72,000. So, you know, I don't know why WWE embellishes these numbers. I mean, I know why they probably do, so they can say, you know, they can beat out the Super Bowl or just make it harder for other events to top those numbers when they run the same venue. But, you know, it's like, can we not have something legitimate when it comes to pro wrestling? You know, it's like everything else is a work, but you can't leave the attendance figures alone. Does 72,000 really sound so much worse than 80? Is that a bad number? It's just so stupid to me. Even on the pregame show. That was the very first one they ever did, by the way, for this year's WrestleMania. They did that pregame show. They had Scott Stanford, Jim Ross, Dusty Rhodes. I was at that show live, so I couldn't hear Scott Stanford. I could see them up on the screen. But my brother told me later on they kept saying 87,000. We're expecting 87,000 fans for WrestleMania. And then during the show, they had Michael Cole on commentary saying that they had almost 80,000. Now, let me tell you something. If you have Michael Cole on commentary during the show saying that they have almost 80,000 fans in the building, guess what? That number is definitely less than 80,000. Because if it was more, there's no way in hell they'd ever let him say something like that on TV and give a lower number. I mean, this isn't like WCW where they had 41,000 people in the Georgia Dome for that one Nitro with Goldberg versus Hogan, and yet on TV, Tony Schiavone claimed they had 39,000. And again, it was Zane Breslov who was working for WCW at that time. He revealed the actual figure. I've never seen a promotion shortchange their own attendance before. I mean, I've heard of companies inflating them, but not shortchanging them. So, anyway, after that long-winded rant, long story short, believe what you want to believe. I believe that this SummerSlam still, to this date, has the highest attendance ever for a WWE show. Davey Boy Smith won the Intercontinental title from Bret Hart, first and only time in history that an Intercontinental Championship match has ended a major pay-per-view. And finally, in 1994, SummerSlam came to us from Chicago with a main event of Undertaker versus Underfaker, played by Brian Lee, and a Bret Hart-Owen Hart steel cage match for the WWF title that, to this day, is my favorite cage match of all time. There was no blood. There was nothing overly violent. It really was just more of a great wrestling match that just so happened to be inside a cage. But I thought they used the cage to perfection. They told a story. I loved it. It's my favorite cage match. 23 years ago this week, August 27, 1990, SummerSlam, Texas Tornado fills in for an injured Brutus Beefcake. That was when Beefcake was in that parasailing accident and had his face completely destroyed. Tornado beat Mr. Perfect for the Intercontinental title. This is the second time, by the way, that Beefcake was pulled from an IC title match at SummerSlam. Beefcake had handed Perfect his first singles loss in WWF at WrestleMania that year, which is just insane to think about, that they wasted Perfect's undefeated streak by just having him lose a random match to Brutus Beefcake. So anyway, I don't know that he would have won the title here. Maybe Perfect would have gotten his win back and retained. So, you know, maybe they just did the title change as a make good for Beefcake being pulled from the match. Otherwise, it makes no sense why they abruptly took the title off Kerry Von Erich 3 months later. Sapphire was supposed to have a match with Sensational Queen Sherry, but she was a no-show. Sherry won by forfeit. We later found out that Sapphire had sold out to the Million Dollar Man and left poor Dusty Rhodes and his polka dots. Hart Foundation beat Demolition in a 2-out-of-3 falls match to win back the tag team titles. Great match, probably the best one on the entire show. Hulk Hogan made his big return to the ring after about 4 or 5 months out of action. He beat Earthquake by countout. And Ultimate Warrior beat Rick Rude in a steel cage to retain the WWF title. Also, 23 years ago this week, this was actually only a few days later, September 1st, 1990, famous Memphis wrestling angle involving Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert running down Jerry the King Lawler with his brother Doug Gilbert's car outside the WMC TV studios in the parking lot. This was not like the stuntman being run down by Rikishi's car at Survivor Series. This was Jerry Lawler himself rolling up the hood of the car, getting hit very hard, and then crashing down to the pavement. I mean, this looked sick. And it looked sick enough that people who saw it called the cops. Cops issued a warrant for the arrest of Eddie Gilbert. Lawler had to go back out before the crowd and tell them that it was all just an angle so that people would calm down. And as it was, Lawler did suffer a bad hip injury as a result. It's amazing his injuries were not worse. If you've never seen this angle before, I posted a video of it if you want to see it. You really have to. I posted it up on my Facebook page. The entire thing is up there. So you can go to facebook.com/thesolomonster and friend me on there. It's about a 3.5-minute video. It starts with the angle in studio with Gilbert, you know, being fired. They kick him out. And then the stuff that happens with Lawler, you know, they don't do angles like this anymore. I could tell you that much. 22 years ago this week, on August 26, 1991, SummerSlam emanated from Madison Square Garden. This is my favorite SummerSlam show of all time. Just so many memorable things on this show. You had the match made in heaven with Macho Man and Elizabeth and their fake wedding. They were already married for many years in real life. It was a rare wrestling wedding that went off without a hitch, although that would come after the show. You had the match made in hell, which was the main event of Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior against Sergeant Slaughter, Colonel Mustafa, and General Adnan in a handicap match with Sid Justice as the guest referee. Sid had just come over from WCW. This was his first major WWF appearance. It would also be the Warriors' last, as he was fired after the show by Vince McMahon. He had held up Vince right before the match for more money. I think he got what I believe he claims was a verbal agreement from Vince. Vince probably just told him what he wanted to hear, so he would go out there. He went out, he wrestled, he came backstage, and then he got canned. And he would not return again until WrestleMania the following year. Also on this show, you had the classic Intercontinental title match between Bret Hart and Mr. Perfect. Perfect had a bad back. He's probably hopped up on all kinds of pain pills. He did the honors for Bret, who won his first singles title. Legion of Doom beat the Nasty Boys to become the first and only team in history to be AWA, NWA, and WWF tag team champions. Virgil also beat the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, to become the first and only man to ever win DiBiase's Million Dollar Belt from him. Or as Bobby Heenan would say, steal it from him. That's some dedication right there, man. You know, they kept Virgil with DiBiase for like 4 years before they did the turn at Royal Rumble that year. And when they did, I just remember the roof came off the building. You know, Virgil was so over, you would think he was a main event guy. And when he won the title here, the place exploded. You know, it was easily the pinnacle of Virgil's career. And now he roams the subways of New York City, and it's just very sad. But yeah, 4 years they waited, and the payoff was huge. These days, it's just the nature of TV and everything. You know, there's no way they'd wait that long for a payoff like that. This show also marked the final appearance of Andre the Giant on WWF television. He was in the corner of the Bushwhackers for their match against the Natural Disasters. And speaking of sad, you know, boy, Andre was in real rough shape by this point. He could barely walk. He was hunched over. I think he died about a year and a half after this. And then, who can forget the jailhouse match between the Mountie and the Big Boss Man? This was high comedy here. Mountie lost the match, and as per the rules, he was handcuffed by New York City police officers and taken away to jail for the night. They showed footage of him being taken to the police van. They take him downtown. Hilarity ensues.
Love the way leather feels against your body.
Let me out of here! Let me out of here!
See, that's when they would do comedy and it was actually funny. See, that's one of my all-time favorite angles right there. After the show was the wedding reception for Savage and Liz, which we did not see footage of until about a week later on WWF TV. An all-time classic angle. Elizabeth goes to open one of the gifts. Out pops a King Cobra. Undertaker nails Savage from behind with the urn. Jake terrorizes Elizabeth with the snake when all of a sudden Sid Justice comes to her rescue. The idea was for Sid to be part of that feud with Jake and Taker, and he was scheduled to be part of a Survivor Series match involving Savage and them, but he tore his bicep, and he was out of action until the Royal Rumble. I haven't exactly hidden the fact that the Randy Savage-Jake Roberts angle is my all-time favorite. I loved everything about it. The snake bite angle, the Tuesday in Texas match where Savage slapped Elizabeth, which was huge back then. You know, that's just not something that was done. Go watch those post-match promos from Roberts and Savage on that show, and you tell me that isn't some of the most real stuff WWF was doing back then. It was attitude before WWF even knew what attitude meant. And if there's anything to complain about, it's that they blew the angle off way too quickly without any real payoff. That's the real shame, I think. You know, that feud was money. All we got out of it was a Saturday night's main event match whose only real purpose was to turn Undertaker babyface afterwards. That's it. I think the Flair Savage match at WrestleMania 8 was great, but let's pretend that never happened. If I could go back and book the perfect card for WrestleMania that year, given all the angles they had going on at the time going into that show, it would have been Hogan Flair on top, Savage and Roberts in a loser-leaves-town match, because Roberts was leaving anyway, and the stipulation would have made sense, given the blood feud those two guys had, you know, this company's not big enough for the both of us kind of thing. Keep Bret Hart and Piper together for the IC title, and maybe do Undertaker and Sid, you know, the battle of the big men. Undertaker stays heel, Sid stays babyface, at least for a little while longer. They didn't have to turn him so quickly. They turned him for the Hogan match, but Sid was way over with the crowd at the time, maybe more so than Hogan. I mean, he certainly was at the Royal Rumble that year when he dumped Hogan out of the ring. Place went nuts for Sid. I'd also have done Money Inc. and LOD for the tag team titles, but I understand why they didn't. You know, LOD dropped the belts to DiBiase and IRS in February in a match that LOD actually requested not be filmed. So it never aired on TV. Reason they dropped the belt so quickly is because Hawk failed a drug test, so they disappeared for a while. They came back at WrestleMania to do a promo. They didn't even wrestle a match. So, kind of a waste, I think, for the first Road Warriors WrestleMania appearance to be, or at least, you know, and then really their only WrestleMania until 1997, and they do a promo, but there just wasn't enough time to fit them in anywhere, and I guess they already had the Money Inc. Natural Disasters program going on, so can't really fault WWE for that one. 19 years ago this week, on August 27, 1994, during a show at the ECW Arena in Philadelphia, Shane Douglas defeated Two Cold Scorpio in the finals of a tournament to determine a new NWA World Heavyweight Champion. ECW was part of the NWA at that time, and in celebrating his victory, Douglas threw down the NWA title and proclaimed himself the new ECW World Heavyweight Champion. And it was not the first screw job in wrestling, it certainly would not be the last, but they definitely screwed the NWA on this one. They had no idea this was going to happen. Dennis Coraluzzo, who was there representing the NWA, he didn't know what to make of it. He thought it was probably just the ECW guys running their own angle, only it was no angle. A few days later on ECW TV, Todd Gordon announced the promotion was changing its name from Eastern Championship Wrestling to Extreme Championship Wrestling. And the rest, as they say, is history. Ironically, it was on the same date, 5 years later, in 1999, that ECW finally debuted on national cable television on the Nashville Network, which the very next year would morph into the National Network when they picked up WWE and they dropped ECW like a bad habit. Today, that network is known as Spike TV. It airs TNA Wrestling. The show's ratings pretty much fluctuated between an 0.7, 0.8, all the way up to as high as a 1.3. So not really all that different than what TNA does these days. Fact is, you know, ECW had barely a year on national cable television before they got dropped, and they died 6 months after that. TNA, for all of its faults, has been on the air with Spike now for 8 years and has been in existence for longer than ECW was. So I would pose this question to you. Which was the more successful promotion, ECW or TNA? Everyone associates, you know, bingo halls with ECW, but ECW did crowds of 4, 5, 6,000 people for some of their shows. And so is TNA, but not as many as they should, considering they've been on national TV and international TV, too. TNA does very well, from what I understand, globally. They're very popular overseas in some parts of the world. They got national TV, international TV. They've been around a lot longer. You know, ECW had pay-per-view. TNA has pay-per-view, although they've cut back. ECW had some big names come through. TNA obviously has had some big names. But take into account their lasting impact. You know, no pun intended. The legacy of each promotion. ECW, with all the stars Paul Heyman helped make, all the international stars they brought over, like Rey Mysterio and guys like that, and the careers that those guys went on to have, the hardcore stuff, the chair shots, the barbed wire. I know TNA is backed by a big energy company. ECW never had that sort of backing. I know ECW is dead. TNA is still alive. But which was the more successful overall? I think that's a good question to pose. I would say ECW. Hands down. If not for the comparisons I just made, for the simple fact that it changed the wrestling industry. You know, for better or worse, you can debate that all night long. I can't say that I was the biggest ECW fan when they were around. I didn't mind them. I watched a few shows late at night at like 3 o'clock in the morning on the MSG Network here in New York. And it was certainly different than what I was used to seeing on WWF television. But, you know, all that stuff we saw during the Attitude Era, you know, WWF Attitude, the tables, the ladders, the chairs, all that stuff, garbage cans, cookie trays, all the tits and ass. You know, all that came from ECW. It influenced an entire era of wrestling. And to this day, you know, not as much as you used to, but you still hear ECW chants when certain people walk out. In 10 years, are we going to hear TNA chants? What mark has TNA made on the wrestling business? The problem with TNA is, you know, they've made no mark. They're just there. They exist. If they folded tomorrow, it would be terrible for wrestling because a lot of guys would be out of work, and there's no way WWE is going to pick them all up. Yeah, it's nice to have an alternative. All those things. There's a lot of good reasons why TNA should still be around. But if another promotion sprung up, let's say 6 months later from the ashes, and took its place, would people really be nostalgic about TNA? I think that's the biggest difference between the two companies. Finally here, 6 years ago this week, on August 30th, 2007, WWE suspended 10 superstars for violating its wellness policy after many of its talent had their names linked to Signature Pharmacy out of Orlando, which was raided by law enforcement earlier in the year for illegally distributing steroids and other drugs to its clients. The names included Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero, who had already passed away. Also Randy Orton, who, interestingly enough, was the only person not suspended. Edge was on that list, Ken Anderson, Umaga, Shane Helms, Chavo Guerrero, John Morrison, William Regal, Charlie Haas, and Sho Funaki. Damn, man, Funaki got wrapped up in that stuff. That's terrible. So that was 6 years ago this week. And that wraps up this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag you want to send in to me, again, please email them to me at thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. For those of you who have emailed me over the last week and haven't heard back, I am getting through the emails one by one. These last few weeks, I've gotten a ton of emails. I've read them all. I'm just trying to respond if I didn't answer them already on the show. You can also follow me on Twitter, @Solemnmonster, and friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolemnmonster. Again, we have video up there of the Eddie Gilbert, Jerry Lawler angle. And the Sound Off also has a group on Facebook. If you type in Solemnmonster Sounds Off, we have a fan page that you could like, but there is a separate discussion group. A lot of people have joined over the last week or so, and you can apply for membership there. I will approve you, and you can be part of our discussion group on Facebook. And again, we've picked up a lot of new members. Hopefully you are one of them. We also have a free app in the Google Play Store. For those of you with Android devices, if you want to listen to the Sound Off for free in app form, type in the name of the show in the Google Play Store. You can find us there. Please leave a review. And you can subscribe in iTunes. So I think that covers all the important stuff for this week. I want to thank you all for downloading the show. For those of you who live here stateside, hopefully you will enjoy a day off for Labor Day this week. So until next time, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here for episode 291 of the Solemnmonster Sounds Off. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solemnmonster Sounds Off, giving you the good. The bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the ugly.
Hello. Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? The fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-fab you.
You're going to K-fab me?
Solemnmonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on thesolemnmonster.com, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio, the Solemnmonster Sounds Off.